Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Don't miss the Crick, Rick, and Jonathan Show every Saturday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Studio B, right here at Revolution Radio.
The journey begins to fun, health, and freedom.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings.
The time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you got it.
Rick, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hand of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me,
give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their global partners are destroying the deep state criminal power structure that has ruled over our planet for hundreds of years.
We are free with the God-given rights, and we shall not yield that right to any power on earth.
Hi, I'm Scott McKay. The world is at, and I am your host on The Tipping Point. On Revolution Radio, where every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, we bring you the latest in this ensuing takedown of this global criminal empire.
That's an image of strength.
You'll get the raw, hard truth here on The Tipping Point. So come join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Okay, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to Free Association. This is Revolution Radio. It's 4 p.m. here, just after 4 p.m., just after 11 a.m. on the East Coast in the States. You're listening to Free Association. My name's Dennis, and I've prepared a show this week, so I've kind of got recordings. I recorded something yesterday on Rumble, on my channel on Rumble, which I thought is worth playing. And then I've got a piece which is the Grey Zone interviewing Jeffrey Sachs, which is from about 2 weeks ago, maybe a little bit longer, but it's about the Nord Stream pipeline and about the conflict in Ukraine. So I thought that's worth playing. I think it's an important interview. Jeffrey Sachs seems to be a man who'll speak his mind, and I think that's to be applauded, even though he's in a position of authority and he's still prepared to speak his mind. I think it's important, so I thought I'd play it, even though it's a couple of weeks old. And the week he has been up and down again. as it seems to always be at the moment. We did have a prime minister, and now we don't have a prime minister anymore. So British politics is a bit of a roller coaster ride at the moment. There is the potential for the return of Boris Johnson, which some people want to see happen, and other people definitely don't want to see happen. Rishi Sunak is now officially over the threshold of 100 MPs, which means that he's standing. The last figures that I saw were Penny Mordaunt was on about 50 MPs and Boris Johnson was on about 50 MPs. But to be able to stand, they need to have 100 MPs backing them. So it may or may not turn out to be a three-way contest. It could just turn out to be Rishi Sunak. If everybody gets behind one candidate, then there isn't any way the other two can get to 100 MPs. So that's the way to avoid the contest that they want to avoid, and then to install Rishi Sunak as Prime Minister. So I don't know whether it'll happen that way, but the contest's only for a week. So by this time next week, we should know who the British Prime Minister is. and then we've got until next May before the local elections happen, and that'll be the big test. Anybody who can get the Tories through the local elections in May next year and not be completely wiped out is doing a pretty good job, I think. Also, a lot of things can happen in 6 or 7 months, but there is always the possibility of a Conservative Party wipeout. If the local elections don't go well, they've got about a year to decide what they want to do with the guy or the woman who's leading them. And I don't think they can change after May next year, but if it's a wipeout, they might have to. So whoever goes in, well, Rishi Sunak is probably a bit more stable than that. He's probably going to be okay. Penny Mordaunt, bit of a snake, stab you in the back at the first opportunity. Maybe not quite up to Prime Minister material. Rishi Sunak's a political mind, but he's not as much of a political mind as Penny Mordaunt is. And obviously Boris is just Boris. Boris will just be Boris, but in a slightly more moderate way. And he's still being investigated over the parties that were happening while we weren't allowed to have parties. So there's a parliamentary committee discussing that, which has still got to report. So if they put him back in as Tory leader and then he gets censured for parties that shouldn't really have happened but did, and were they actually parties, and was he actually there? All of these questions. And obviously he's lied to Parliament about the whole thing. So he'll get censured for lying to Parliament, for not telling the complete truth. And then he may face a re-selection process in his local constituency, which means that he might end up being deselected, at which point he can only be a Tory party leader at that point if he goes to the House of Lords. God help us all if Boris Johnson ends up in the House of Lords. But he might. And there's a lot of things that could happen between now and then, though. It's all very hypothetical. I've got a slightly different topic from yesterday. So I'm going to play this piece that I put onto Rumble yesterday afternoon. I was having a conversation with somebody on Facebook, and I found a picture of Klaus Schwab. Like a 50-50 picture of Klaus Schwab on one side and Ernst Stavros Blofeld on the other. So I posted that and it provoked a conversation on Facebook. So inspired me to record a video for Rumble. So this is that video. How the sound is today. I'm just chilling out and having a conversation with whoever the people are on Rumble who might be watching. And I don't know whether, does Russell Brand do a live show on Fridays? I don't know. Anyway, with a friend of mine on Facebook, and I posted the beginning of the thread. I'll just describe what was being, I'll give it a bit of context. So the beginning of the thread was a picture that I found online of Klaus Schwab on one side and Ernst Blofeld, who's a James Bond villain from the early 70s, on the other side of the picture. So equating the two together, basically. So, and I posted it with time to call a terrorist a terrorist. So nobody would have any problem with calling Ernst Blofeld a terrorist. Why do we have a problem with calling Klaus Schwab a terrorist? That's my question. Nobody wants to do it, so I'm doing it. He's a fucking terrorist. The guy's a terrorist. All of that nudge unit, NLP-based, cognitive behavioural manipulation that happened over the last 2 years is terrorism. It's fucking terrorism. There is no other way to describe it. There are still people wandering around now with masks on. That's how much of a terrorist attack it was. 2 years later, there are still people wandering around with masks on. So, here's my question. If this was a James Bond movie, which it may well be, if it was the plot to a James Bond movie, which James Bond movie would it be? Give me your answer in the comments. If you're watching this live or later on, however it works, and I'll read them. And another question. So if the war in Ukraine was a James Bond movie, which Bond movie would it be? Which one does it resemble the most? If the Nord Stream gas pipeline sabotage was in a Bond movie, which Bond movie would it be? Which does it resemble the most? So to me, there isn't really a reason why Russia would attack its own pipeline. That doesn't make any sense at all to me, particularly when it's already switched off. It's just stupid, inane, cretinous thinking that would even consider that. Why would he do it? He's got no financial reason to cut his own arm off, which is effectively what he was doing. There is no reason for him to do it. So, to me, he didn't do it. So who are the other suspects? But the United States has a relationship with Europe that it wants to be a particular way. Germany and Russia have a reciprocal arrangement that involves a gas pipeline, which moves Germany closer to the orbit of Russia, makes it more dependent on Russia than it is on the United States. So that's a threat to the United States. And there was, apparently, some kind of naval exercise in the Baltic Sea at the beginning of September 2022. I forget the name of the ship, but I posted it on the thread on Facebook. But it was a ship that had the capacity to mine a pipeline. And they were on exercises in the Baltic Sea at the beginning of September. So there's motive and opportunity right there. Motive and opportunity. Israel has gas. Israel has a gas pipeline. Israel needs a market for its gas. So, if a pipeline constructed by a rival gas supplier happened to be inoperable, that would give Israel the opportunity to supply gas to that particular market, or part of that market. So there's the who benefits. It's a combination of the United States and Israel. Right there. So none of this is rocket science. It's just a James Bond movie. All you've got to do is look at it like it's a James Bond movie. Ian Fleming was in the British Secret Service. He knew what was going on behind the scenes. He knew how things worked. And obviously it's been exaggerated for the movies and all the rest of it. But the basic principles are the same. Basic principle is there's a bald-headed guy with a cat on his lap, cackling demonically into the camera as he tells the audience what he's going to do. So that's Ernst Blofeld and Klaus Schwab. Klaus Schwab doesn't have the cat, but he does have an outfit that looks like it came from Atlantis, which is interesting to me as well. So then you've got, so that's the World Economic Forum connection. So one of the people who's an advisor to the World Economic Forum is Yuval Noah Harari, who was mentored by the guy at Google who's into the transhumanism, Ray Kurzweil. So Ray Kurzweil's got an indirect input into the World Economic Forum, which means Google's got an indirect input. So there's that going on. One of the other people who's an advisor to the World Economic Forum is one of the Hoffman-LaRoche people. So Hoffman-LaRoche is a pharmaceutical company that owns the patent for remdesivir and owns the patent to PCR tests. So they make money whether there's a pandemic or not, as long as there's a fear of a pandemic. So there's that. So that's transhumanism and profits from pandemic-related stuff taken care of. So, yeah. It's a James Bond movie plot. It's very simply a James Bond movie plot, but it's real. And there are people's lives at stake. But when one company owns the patents to two or three different things that are a key part of the plot, that makes that company suspect. And then one of the family members who's a key shareholder in that particular company is an advisor to Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum. That makes the company very suspect. To me, at least. And there's a documentary called Coronagate, which sets quite a lot of this out, which you can find on BitChute. I don't know whether it's on Rumble, but it might be. It may not be, but it should be. It should definitely be on Rumble. If it isn't, then it should be. So I might well transfer it from BitChute to Rumble at some point. And I've got some time, which is probably later on today. So, what we've got is a profit motive and a control motive. The other thing that's suspicious to me is that all of these delivery companies popped up about 2 years before there was a pandemic, when everybody was forced to be in their house and order food from a takeaway. That's suspicious to me. So I would be interested in the people who were the venture capitalists on those particular businesses. I think they're suspect as well. Because Deliveroo and Uber Eats don't happen by themselves. They don't happen by themselves. And if the venture capitalists are planning a 5-year exit strategy and they need a big profit to be able to do that, and they know there's going to be a pandemic because the virus has been experimented on for 25 years, which it has, and if they know that the people are likely to be trapped in their houses and looking for deliveries, that would make a food delivery company the perfect place to put an investment. It's suspicious to me because we didn't have food delivery companies 10 years ago. They've suddenly appeared. And then there's suddenly a huge market for them. That doesn't seem coincidental to me. That seems like it's a plan of some sort. So, what we've got is a James Bond plot that involves venture capitalists and a large pharmaceutical company in Switzerland. Not to mention Pfizer and Moderna. Moderna. Look at fucking Moderna with a fine tooth comb. They're working with a military industrial complex in the States for the last 10 years. So the military industrial complex in the States becomes a suspect in this particular James Bond plot. And then there's a guy called James Giordano, who's a chemist and a neuroethics specialist who works with the American military industrial complex. And he has got the idea that there was a loophole in the legislation, which means that dual use military and health applications mean that the things you can't get approval for militarily, you can do as a health experiment. That makes the military-industrial complex suspect in this thing that's happening, in this James Bond plot. So, we've got the American military-industrial complex, we've got Israel, and the military-industrial complex based around Israel, probably funded by the Rothschilds, but I haven't looked into it in any detail. There's some serious security issues around Israel and the Talpiot program and Unit 8200, all of which I need to look at a bit more closely, which may form part of this James Bond movie plot that's developing. So there's espionage, there's industrial espionage, moving technology from the United States through Israel into Russia, into China, into Iran potentially, if a drone happens to be pulled out of the sky in somewhere over Iran. And they get access to the technology, then the company that produced that technology will get another contract to produce better technology, newer technology. Because once a code's broken, it becomes useless. You need a new set of tech, a new code. So this James Bond movie becomes quite complicated and involves a lot of different companies and a lot of different players, political players, industrial players. It's difficult to keep track of, but there's the opportunity to start keeping track of it once you know the plot. Once you start to understand the characters and the plot twists and the fact that it's a movie, so everything is possible. And this is real politique. It's Kissinger and associates. So my enemy's enemy is my friend, potentially. The whole thing can flip on its head at any point and become the opposite of what it was. That's how a James Bond plot works. So it's Friday afternoon, and I'm chilling out a bit. That was a bit of a rant, but I am pretty chilled out, it has to be said. That was a 16-minute rant. All right, so I recorded that yesterday. I'm getting better at monologues. I'm practicing a little bit, but I'm getting better at them. I should have warned you there was a couple of F-bombs in there where I forgot. I was pretty much stream of consciousness yesterday. But I was happy with that one, so I thought I'd share it. All right, so the second part of the show, what was I going to do? I'm going to do Jeffrey Sachs from a couple of weeks ago. This is about the Nord Stream pipeline as well. So that's kind of the theme that's running through the show. So this is an interview he did with the Grey Zone. It was uploaded on October the 9th, so presumably it would have been recorded the day before, probably. Here we go. This is about half an hour. I'll let it run. It'll take us through to more or less the end. I might cut it off about 20 minutes or 25 minutes in, but I'll run the bulk of it because it's a good interview.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Aaron Matte here with Max Blumenthal, editor of The Gray Zone, and we are joined by Jeffrey Sachs. He is director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University, president of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network, and served as chair of the Lancet COVID-19 Commission. Jeffrey Sachs, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to get your take on the latest in Ukraine. President Zelensky has just called for preemptive strikes against Russia, although a spokesperson later clarified and said he meant preventive sanctions. Biden, meanwhile, talking about the world not being in the situation of facing the prospect of Armageddon since the Cuban Missile Crisis, also claiming that Putin is not joking when he talks about the potential use of tactical nuclear weapons or biological or chemical weapons. That's Biden saying that, although I haven't heard Putin say any of that specifically. Meanwhile, Biden also said that the U.S. is trying to figure out an off-ramp for Putin. My question to you is, what do you make of this charged rhetoric right now? And do you think the U.S. is actually seriously interested in seeking an off-ramp at this stage?
Well, I take all of this very seriously because we have a war between two nuclear superpowers. So this is a terrible situation. This is a war between Russia and the United States. The U.S. Does not have that many people on the ground. We don't know who really is on the ground in Ukraine from the U.S., but a lot of weapons are finance, intelligence. This is the U.S. is fighting this war, and this is quite clear. And that means two sides, each that have arsenals of 1,600 or so active nuclear weapons in a war that is of tremendous significance for Russia on its border, and so far where the United States is saying we will continue to do whatever it takes to defeat Russia. Well, when you have superpowers talking in that way, you better damn take it as a big threat. And I have not appreciated the U.S. policies in this all along because I think I'm actually a little relieved in a weird way that Biden said this, because I felt this all along. I felt that the U.S. policy was on a path of escalation and that they didn't have an off-ramp in their minds. By the way, there's an obvious off-ramp, and this is the whole point of this war, if you really know something about it from the beginning. And the off-ramp is that NATO says we're not going to enlarge to Ukraine, period. That was the off-ramp that would have prevented the war. That was the off-ramp that would have stopped this war in March when Russia and Ukraine, under the mediation of Turkey, exchanged documents and said publicly, as well as the Turkish mediators, we're close to an agreement. Many of us think that the U.S. rushed in and said, oh, no, don't do that. You know, we don't know ever with our government what's really going on because they don't tell the truth. That just goes with the business of government, the way that it's viewed in Washington. But my feeling is that there are a lot of signs that the U.S. has been against a negotiated end to this war, because my interpretation is that this issue of NATO enlargement is a deeply held objective of the United States going back to the early 1990s. It's as deeply rejected by Russia since that time. I've watched it on both sides. That's why we have a collision course that continues to escalate, and why we should take damn seriously this nuclear threat. But why Biden should ask himself, okay, well, good. He's asking, what's the off ramp? I'll give him the suggestion. We should never have suggested NATO enlargement to Ukraine. And we should stop now, because Putin was very clear at the end of 2021. Here are my red lines. And the core of them, the core of the red lines was neutrality of Ukraine. And I called the White House then. I said, that's good. That's actually right. That's not just a concession. That is right for all sides. The White House said, yeah, we don't like that. We believe Ukraine has the right to join NATO. I said, it's not a right because it impinges directly on Russia's core security perceptions. You better talk. No, we're not talking about that. Well, they better talk. That's my bottom line. They really had better talk about this issue. By the way, you can't have Zelensky negotiating with Putin. This is a war between the U.S. and Russia. And we need to have the President of the United States and the President of Russia talking with each other and avoiding Armageddon. That's, I think, the bottom line.
And Zelensky, by the way, said he wouldn't even negotiate with Russia insofar as Putin is in power. So Zelensky's taking care of that problem already, I guess.
Look, you know, I've studied the Cuban Missile Crisis all my life, all my professional adult life. I wrote a book about the aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I've looked at this issue in great detail. We came close to nuclear Armageddon exactly 60 years ago this month, by the way. And during that period, one of the provocations was Castro saying, fire, fire, telling Khrushchev, you know, make a preemptive strike, just what Zelensky's doing right now. You could kind of understand it. But you know what Khrushchev said when Castro said, you know, you should make a preemptive strike? Khrushchev said, my God, this is supposedly our ally who would end the world. We better negotiate. We better speed up the negotiations because this is not stable. And when Zelensky says these things, I'm horrified. And yeah, they walked it back, but he didn't say sanctions, by the way. He said preemptive strike, and Zelensky has said similar things. And they talk recklessly, maybe understandably, given their circumstance. I don't think so. I don't like it. And I think it shows how unstable this is. And by the way, during this whole period of this proxy war, where this is really a confrontation between Russia and the United States, we have pretended that it's a confrontation only between Russia and Ukraine, first of all. And we've said constantly, whatever Ukraine says, this is, you know, that's the right thing. And so we're kind of giving carte blanche to the most extravagant, dangerous, provocative statements. And another example, okay, you know, we don't know for 100%, but let me do a little quiz. Russia is in control right now of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. It is being shelled. We hear that's very dangerous, which it is. You shouldn't shell nuclear power plants. Now, one side controls the plant. So who is actually shelling the plant? Well, our media say, oh, we don't know who's shelling the plant. And they can't put one and one together to say, well, if Russia's in control of the plant, maybe they're not shelling their own plant. Maybe it's Ukraine shelling the plant. Well, I can tell you, I speak to a lot of people. It's almost surely Ukraine shelling the power plant. And we can't bring ourselves to express a simple truth. And that hurts because they continue to shell the power plant with impunity. And we should say, stop shelling the power plant. Yes, it would be good if you had control of the power plant, we can say to them, but don't shell a nuclear power plant. But we can't even find those words. That's the problem, because we're kind of faking the whole thing as if this isn't a U.S.-Russia thing. Then we say, okay, do it. Go defeat Putin. That's great. That's what we want. defeat the guy with 1,600 active nuclear warheads and several thousand more in reserve. Go ahead, go do it. As if this isn't our Armageddon that we're heading to. And that's really been a massive failure of this administration till now. One thing I've learned in, I'm 67 years old, I've been through a lot of U.S. wars, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Nicaragua, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Libya, Yemen, and more. It's the job of the President of the United States to put on the brakes, because this country is a war machine at the top. We don't see it. We don't know it exactly. Eisenhower told us about it with the military-industrial complex. This country is a war machine. The main job of the President of the United States is to stop the war machine from making wars. And we are now in an escalation heading towards Armageddon, according to the president. That's not a spectator sport. That's his job, to keep us away from Armageddon.
And Professor Sachs, you said this is a war between the U.S. and Russia. We've heard threat after threat, or call after call, for an end to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland to Joe Biden himself. Senator Ron Johnson, in questioning Nuland, appeared to actually call for the sabotage of the pipeline.
But I'm literally talking about rolling back the pipeline, and loosely define that, but I mean taking action that will prevent it from ever becoming operational.
And so who do you think is responsible for the worst act of industrial sabotage in recent memory, and maybe in long memory? And what would their motive be, considering that the German economy was on the hook here?
You know, I've said I wasn't there, but my guess is, just like I think Ukraine is shelling the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, I think the United States blew up Nord Stream. And they told us, you know, Biden said it in February, said if Putin invades, Nord Stream is over. And then a reporter said, well, what do you mean, Mr. President? How are you going to do that? He said, we have our ways. We have our ways.
We will bring an end to it.
But how will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
We will, I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
Come on. Who controls the airspace? Who monitors the airspace? Who has the means to do this? Who said we're going to do it? Who said afterwards, this is a tremendous opportunity, this new situation, a tremendous opportunity to permanently wean Europe from Russian gas? That would be Secretary of State Blinken. Who said, thank you, USA, tweeting a picture of the burst pipeline? That would be Radek Sikorski, former foreign minister of Poland. And by the way, you know, I've been in touch with reporters in papers that say, we don't know, or even worse, who say Russia did this. And then I talk to very senior reporters and they say, Jeff, of course it's the U.S. What do you think? But it doesn't get into our news. My guess is that we're going to hear from Europe's investigators in a week or so. Very hard. We don't know. Trail went cold. Very hard to tell. We'll keep looking, but we don't know. But terrible blow, terrible blow. That would be consistent with the U.S. doing it. And the fact that things went a bit quiet after this, rather than parliamentarians throughout Europe demanding our core infrastructure was blown up, tells me that they're told, keep it quiet, keep it quiet. We don't really want to know exactly what happened. So I can't prove this, but it sure does, to my mind, put all the suspicion on the U.S. side. Warnings, motive, capability, subsequent behavior, strange statements. To my mind, it adds up. I don't think Russia would blow up its core infrastructure. That doesn't make sense. And anyone else that did it would, you know, with Poland or Denmark or anyone else, that would be NATO. That would be with the U.S.
President Joe Biden has said, Professor Sachs, that there will be an investigation into what he has deemed an act of deliberate sabotage. He said he'll send divers down, which is interesting because he knows that divers can reach it. But do you think that this investigation will be a whitewash like the kind we saw the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons carry out, where inspectors were actually censored and even attacked by OPCW leadership around the Douma, Syria chemical weapon attack allegations in April 2018? And what do you make specifically of that allegation? My colleague here, Aaron Mate, has done as much to expose the cover-up as anyone, so it's a real issue of interest here.
Well, on this, you know, the pipeline, the U.S. can't be the one investigating if the U.S. is the most likely culprit. I mean, they can, but we're not going to find any credibility in what comes out of this. So I think the idea of an independent and transparent investigation would be great, but I'm not holding my breath. So the U.S. may say something. Again, I'm 67 years old. It took me a long time to grow up to know that almost everything we hear is not true. We are a security state. We have a secret state, which runs most of our foreign and military policy, of course, and we don't hear the real thing. So I'm not putting too much stock in what the...
All right, that's Jeffrey Sachs. Jeffrey Sachs is a senior guy. He was the chair of the panel that looked into the origins of the coronavirus. So he knows what's going on. He's a sharp cookie, and he's saying what he can while still being senior and while still being within the system. So whether he would be able to say more if he was outside of the system, he wouldn't have access to the people he's got access to if he was outside of the system. So we have to kind of work. I'll work from the outside because I don't have access to anybody, but the people on the inside have got to work as well. And between us, we'll get to some truth somewhere down the line. That's kind of the idea anyway. I mean, this show's kind of turned into a geopolitics show. I don't necessarily want to keep it a geopolitics show, but it's relevant because it is a grand chessboard. Zygmunt Brzezinski wrote all this down in 1997 and prior to that, and Kissinger wrote the same types of things down in the 70s and the 60s and the 80s. It's the same, and before that, of course, there was European family disputes in the 18th century and the 17th century, all family disputes, rows between cousins, basically, but with countries. So the Russians and the Prussians and Austro-Hungarian Empire, and it becomes just an endless soap opera. But unfortunately, there are millions and millions of people's lives and livelihoods at stake. So the more we understand it in simple terms, the more it's possible to predict it, if we're understanding it correctly. And that's kind of my task when I'm watching these videos and listening to these people talk. My task is to understand it in simple enough terms that I don't have to spend my whole life looking at it, but with enough understanding that I can predict what happens next. That's my kind of basic principle. So I'm not quite there yet, but I'm getting the hang of it, because it's not that difficult to predict once you kind of get the hang of the principles of it. So it's all about mineral resources, ultimately, trade routes, and power. Once you've got those things in place, if you've got the minerals and you've got the trade routes and you've got the money supply, you've got the power. So it's a lot of old men trying to hold on to power. And They all grew up during the Second World War. That was their formative years. So the Second World War and the Cold War is how they think, which means that they're playing out their thought process in the physical world before they die, because that's the only way they know how to play the game. Hopefully the next generation will know how to play the game in a different way. It doesn't involve quite so many people dying. I've got some serious, serious concerns about Elon Musk at the moment. And he's a player in this thing as well. But he's got Starlink over Ukraine, and that's keeping the Ukrainians going. So the other thing he's got is the Neuralink, putting a chip into your brain kind of process, which is a concern. It's serious transhumanism. Serious, serious transhumanism. I don't think there's anything I can do about it, but I can talk about it a little bit here and there. Let people know that it exists and it's heading in this particular direction. And then hopefully when it gets to the point where everybody has to say no, there'll be enough people to understand to say no collectively. And Elon Musk can just go and live in a mansion on a mountain somewhere with his pool full of sharks and crocodiles and piranhas in exactly the same way that Ernst Blofeld would do. And live out his retirement as far away from people as possible. But I don't think he's trustworthy at all. I don't think he's a character who's at all trustworthy. So, yeah, I don't know what we can do about all of this stuff yet. I get overwhelmed by the whole thing sometimes. And I don't want to be overwhelmed by the whole thing, but I have to look at it in my own way. I'm using the radio show as a way to look at it in a kind of contained way. Otherwise, it would just overwhelm me and I would give up. But I'm not doing that. I'm back to being on the Tyne Bridge a couple of times a month. I'm going to go up to Stand in the Park tomorrow and reconnect with people. I was at a demonstration last week on Saturday afternoon just before I did the show. And there was maybe 50 or 60, 70 people up there when I was there. And it hadn't really officially started. It was just kind of getting going. So it was a good turnout. Newcastle's not that big a place. It's a reasonably sized provincial town, city. We've just had a huge influx of new office blocks into the city centre. Mostly controlled by the university, but there's another set of blocks going up on the other side of town, by the Swan Roundabout, which is by the Tyne Bridge, and that's a district that was warehouse. It was a warehouse district and an old bus station and the old court building, some of which is listed and can't be touched, but the rest of it's being pulled down. So there's a lot of development space, and it's all been bought up by, I think it's the Rubin brothers. I can't remember if it's exactly the Rubin brothers, but it's a couple of brothers from Israel, I think, who've bought it all up piecemeal, a little bit at a time, but it's built up into a big office block collection. So the whole of that particular side of the town is going to be brand spanking new and shiny in a couple of years' time. And it'll bring a whole lot of people into town who can then eat at the restaurants that were put into town about 5 years ago that have never had quite enough people to cover the costs. But the city council's working hard to bring people into town so they can eat at the restaurants and shop in the retail malls and drink in the bars and keep the nighttime economy going. So it's been planned. The redevelopment of the city's been planned over a long period of time. And the council's done quite a reasonable job of making it an international city now, which it never used to be. But it's also on the UN Smart Cities list. which is a concern. But I'm keeping an eye on it. I'm gonna keep a close eye on it over the next few years and make sure people know what's going on. Provided I've got evidence for it. I'm not gonna just go out on an imaginative flight of fancy. I need to have evidence for everything I say. Otherwise, nobody will take me seriously in this particular city. So it's important that I've got the evidence to back it up. But I'm looking. I'm looking in roughly speaking, the right places now. I know where to look. And I know how to research. And I'm getting the hang of how to express things in a way that people understand it without thinking all that hard about it, where it just clicks into place. It's taken a bit of time and a bit of practice, but I'm getting there slowly but surely. So I'm developing a bit of a channel on BitChute now as well, and on Rumble. I've kind of committed to at least a couple of live streams on Rumble a week. It's been a couple of days while the Liz Truss prime ministerial shenanigans have been going on. But it'll be less. I'm going to take a break from the politics because it just does my head in completely. But there will still be a couple of live streams a week, plus the radio show, plus the podcast. So that's enough to keep me going. So you can find me on Rumble, on BitChute, on Odyssey, under the name of Radio Projects usually. Or you can find me anywhere you can download a podcast. If you look for Free Association Radio Show Roundtable and Podcast, that'll find me straight away. Revolution Radio is listener supported. It's been around for about 12 years and still going strong. But we do need your help. We need the donations to keep the servers running and to pay for bandwidth. We're all volunteers. There's 85 hosts, I think, at the moment, something like that, maybe 90 by now. Two servers running 24 hours a day. There's still some spaces on Studio B. And there's always the option of the Hawk's Nest if you want to do a show. Speak to the management and tell them what you want to do and what time slot you're looking for. Have a look and see if there's a time slot available. Then speak to the management. I'm sure they'll be able to help you out. They're a good bunch of people here. Very supportive, very supportive. When I think back to February 2.5 years ago, whatever it was, what's that, 2019, 2020? I don't know, something like that. 2.5 years ago at least. And I didn't have a clue what I was going to do. I just, Karen suggested I did a show, insisted that I speak to the management, so I went along with it, basically. I didn't know what I was going to be doing. So I booked the slot 2 months in advance to give me time to work out what I wanted to do. And it's taken a couple of years to get there, but starting from just speaking into my phone, which is, we think about it, It's a ridiculous concept, doing a radio show via a mobile phone, but I did it. I did it for about 6 months. And then got a little laptop from China, which helps, but still isn't great, but it was a bit better. And now it's a bit better with another laptop and another gadget and a better quality microphone. So it's all moving in the right direction. I think my particular bit of the world's moving in the right direction. I can't speak for the rest of it. I don't know what's going on with the rest of it. It's all a bit mental. But my little bit of the world's moving in the right direction. And that's good enough for me. So I'll be around Monday to Friday doing the music show on the Hawk's Nest, Technocratic Tyranny Blues. It's been concept albums and jazz funk recently. I'll definitely be doing 4 out of 5. I may do 5 out of 5 now that we're moving into the winter. I've got less kind of enthusiasm for going out now it's a little bit colder. But I still reserve the right to have a day off now and again. So 4 out of 5 and sometimes 5 out of 5. And then the Saturday shows definitely always happens unless I've got technical issues or something serious is going on. I'll keep this one running for the rest of my life, basically. I'm quite happy with the way this one's going. And the music shows a balance to it. I can't talk about eugenics without having some kind of Tangerine Dream concept album from 1975 going on as well. I have to balance the two together. So that's pretty much it. Thanks for listening. I'm having fun with it. I hope you're enjoying it as much as I am. Have a good day. Look after yourself. Treat yourself with kindness. And let the world be good to you.
Everyone, it's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
Are you interested in the paranormal? Murder mystery? Real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's iPhone thinking. Welcome to the Crypt.
What the heck is the truth, jihad? Hey, I'm Kevin Barrett, host of Truth Jihad Radio.